Hi there, listener, and welcome to this special episode of the Ski Podcast. My name is Ian Martin, and today I'm delighted to share my conversation with veteran British ski journalist James Cove. I'm sure many of our listeners will have heard of Planet Ski, the ski news website that James set up almost 20 years ago. In this episode, we discuss his background working for the BBC, first in local radio, then in political news, before he helped to develop their first digital coverage. James has also worked at the Ski Club of Great Britain, is a qualified instructor, and has skied in literally hundreds of resorts around the world. So, sit back and let's listen to my conversation with James Cove, founder of planetski.eu.
I am delighted to welcome James Cove to the Ski Podcast today. Hi, James, how are you?
Hi, Ian, I'm very well, thank you. Very well, you?
I'm good. I am sitting in Brighton. It's very rainy and miserable outside. But looking in your background, I kind of see blue skies. Where are you just now?
Well, I'm actually in Greece at the moment, believe it or not. I'm on a very small little island called Tinos, which probably most people haven't heard of. I tend to do it most autumns, actually. He's come out. I've been in Portugal the last 2 years. I basically come out for a week to somewhere or other to get away from all the distractions, and basically just write a load of copy for the coming season and sort out all the adverts and have a bit of brainstorming about what the coming season is going to be like. Get a bit of sun and swimming in as well. So it's very nice there.
Cool. Well, it sounds like the perfect location for it. A question I always like to ask my guests at the top of the show is, when did you ski or snowboard last? Now, I know you spend a lot of days on snow every year, but when was that for you, James?
The last time I skied and snowboarded was actually the end of March last season, which is fairly rare for me because I normally ski into May. But without being too boring, my eldest son, who's now living in Canada, he was around in April before he emigrated to Canada. And I thought in April, well, I'd rather stick around and see my son than go skiing. But normally I'm skiing into April, which is actually one of my favorite months to go skiing, and then into May. So it was March for me.
Well, I know you get a lot of days on snow. I mean, I'm guessing it's the wrong time of year, but I do know, and some of our listeners might know, that you can ski in Greece as well. I think that's right, isn't it?
You can ski in Greece, actually, rather surprisingly. There's actually 25 different resorts in Greece. I mean, they're not very big, quite frankly. I haven't skied there, but I know friends that have. But yeah, they're fantastic. They're all on the main island. And you can actually ski on Mount Olympus as well, which is one of the things I really want to do. And you could, as well as the skiing, I'm told, there's several resorts you can actually sort of swim in the morning or late afternoon and then ski at the height of the day. I'm a big fan, personally, of just skiing in resorts you haven't heard of. Whenever people ask me, where should I go skiing, my stock answer is always, go somewhere you haven't been. And then they say, well, I go to whatever, La Plan, and I really like La Plan. I said, well, that's fantastic. La Plan's a great ski area, but try somewhere different and, see what happens.
We have actually covered Greece on the podcast before. Gemma Bowes, who you probably know, went out there. I'll stick a link to that into the show notes. But just now, I wondered if I could take you back. I did a bit of research into this before we started. I discovered you went to Tunbridge School. Did you know I went to Judd School in the same town?
Well, I think I was probably a little bit before you, actually.
We didn't quite overlap. You're right. I noticed you did a history degree, which took you to Madame Tussauds, and then postgrad. But you segued into radio journalism, and that was your start for journalism. And I wondered what prompted that change. What made you decide that you were interested in the journalism side and specifically radio?
Well, as you said, I started actually off at Madame Tussauds. I was a historical researcher at Madame Tussauds, and I was taken on to do the research into an exhibition on Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, actually. And then I ended up doing the research on some of the various sort of people they made models of. I remember measuring David Bowie's inside leg at one point, and Dave went to see David Owen from the Gang of Four, and Mrs. Thatcher and all sorts of things. But there was actually a radio voiceover artist there and I was sort of saying, I quite fancy getting into television. I don't know why, I just thought it was glamorous to get into television. And he said, well, why don't you try radio? Radio is a fantastic medium. So I went to do a postgraduate radio diploma in radio journalism at the London College of Printing. And then I got a job down at Radio Sussex in Brighton. So that's where I started off, 1986 it was. And I did the radio. And I still have a massive, massive love of radio, which sort of stems from my days in local radio, actually. I mean, I loved working for BBC Radio Sussex in Brighton. When I ended up in television news up in London several years later, I was always delighted to help out radio any way I could. And also we ended up doing shifts as people running the sort of news desk of radio, which I really enjoyed. A lot of my television colleagues rather looked down their nose at radio. I absolutely love radio.
Yeah, for sure. I think podcasting is the new radio. I mean, I found it really interesting that you're at Radio Sussex in Brighton, literally just down the road from where I am just now. And I mean, I think maybe these days, local radio, following Alan Partridge, had a bit of a bad rap, but it's known as a great training ground. What kind of features or reporting were you doing during your time with Radio Sussex then?
Well, sort of everything. And that's what's so good about local radio. I imagine the staffing now is really, really low level stuff, but there's not many people there. But you did some reports, you know, as a reporter. You read the news, you produced the programmes. Brighton was actually a very, very good patch, as we call it, a good sort of news area, because Brighton, the town, is quite an interesting town. You know, it's got a theatre, there's lots going on. There's a bit of a sort of underbelly to it, shall we say. So there's lots of crime going on. It's a fascinating town, Brighton, as you know. Equally, in the sort of Radio Sussex patch, you know, we had Gatwick Airport, where you get lots of news stories out of Gatwick Airport and all the rest of it. And there's the sort of countryside stories as well. So you can do all the stories about sort of farming. And there was a real sort of mixture of stories then, because there's quite a good university there as well. If you're doing some of the more academic sort of stuff, you can always turn to Professor whoever from the university. So there was a whole range of stories, and most of the best journalists, not all, if you check back on their history, most of them started in local radio or on local newspapers, where you basically learn there's a story in everything, if you can find it. And that the things you learn there, if you go to the local courts, I mean, I went to Lewis Crown Court quite a lot, some of the sort of big murder cases to report on that. You learn all the skills you're going to need later in life as a journalist when you hit the sort of bigger stage, which I ended up doing, in local radio. You know, I look back with very, very fond memories on my days in local radio.
You know, I'd back that up, that Brighton is still an interesting town with so much going on, you know, so much variety. I did notice that, you know, you mentioned you're a reporter and then a newsreader, but you moved on to being a producer and like a field producer on the road. You know, was that an easy transition? That just did that area just interest you more?
Yeah, I mean, it was fairly straightforward. I mean, I did a job when I moved up to London. I mean, I worked on the 1 o'clock news to start with and breakfast news. I didn't really like working on the programme so much. And then I moved into a department called news gathering, without getting too technically boring about how the BBC split up. You have all the programmes and there's dozens and dozens of them. And then a department called news gathering, which is basically, it says on the tin, it gathers news. So that department had all the sort of camera crews and the satellite dishes and the reporters and all the rest of it. And I was either sort of sitting on the main news desk coordinating all that, or when there's what we used to call a big story pops up, you know, whether it's sort of train crashes or IRA bombs, I spent a lot of time in Belfast, actually, then someone like me went out to basically organise it all. And yeah, that's really, that was the, I mean, it sounds awful to say it's fun, because most news stories are pretty horrific, actually. But that was the fun part of the job, just coordinating all the coverage of a big live news story. I don't know, you need the right temperament for it, shall we say, because you've got to get on with a lot of different people, from the sort of egos of the correspondents, no names mentioned, but some of them, you know, really think the world revolves around them, through to the sort of the people operating the satellite dishes. I always took the view that everyone on the team out on a big news story was equal. They were all important. I mean, the reporter can be as good or as they are, and the camera crews can be as great as they want. But if the satellite engine is rubbish, then they're not going to be able to feed the pictures back. Yeah. So it doesn't really matter. So everyone on the team was as important as the other person, in my view.
That's really interesting. You talk about the different events that you used to cover. I think you covered several general elections. Were you following the politicians or the candidates, you know, very closely around the country on a battle bus or something like that?
Yes, well, I did a Paddy Ashdown one back in the day. And then I did a Tony Blair election as well. And then I did the final one with Charlie Kennedy. So I did sort of three of those. I mean, I always call them the so-called battle buses. The image is that the politicians sit on this bus and travel around the country everywhere, meeting all the local people and all the rest of it. The reality, as always, is somewhat different, particularly for someone like Tony Blair. I mean, the bus goes around with all the journalists on it, and they're more often than not so much for the Liberal Democrats. You know, the bus turns up in wherever, sort of Manchester or somewhere on the outskirts. A helicopter lands in a field. You know, out comes Tony Blair. He comes onto the battle bus. You know, we drive in to go to the local hospital or the local school or whatever. He sort of climbs out of the bus waving his arms at everyone. We sort of film it all and do the report, and Tony Blair's visited Manchester, whatever. And then we drive out to another lay-by sort of just outside the town. He gets off the bus, he's taken to some field where there's a helicopter, and he helicopters himself back to London. And that's really what happens in the election campaigns. But again, as a sort of producer, I mean, they're fantastic fun. You're charging around all over the country. You're only giving them 24 hours notice of where you were going to be, because they wanted to keep it all secret. So you never knew where you were going to go. The logistics were quite complicated. So obviously the most important people to getting in contact with were his security details, because they obviously knew exactly where he was going. So you get on with his close protection officers and you say, well, no idea where we're going to be in a couple of days' time, but, you know, would the sort of northeast of England be, somewhere we might be going soon? And you end up finding out where they're going, because then they know that you're not going to sort of, you know, phone up whatever people and tell you where the Prime Minister's going. So you learn pretty quickly what's going on. But they're great fun, but they are terribly stage managed, believe me.
I mean, I guess that doesn't surprise me so much to hear that. You also covered presidential elections in the States as well. Were you there in 2000?
Yes, I went to North America a few times, actually. The best one, actually, was the Salt Lake City Winter Olympics in 2002. I was over for 9/11 in Washington. But I was also there for the George W. Bush, for his election. I was in Austin, Texas. Don't know if you're familiar with Austin in Texas, but Texas, let's say, is a bit sort of Republican redneck, as it were. But there's a little oasis of what I would call normality in Austin, Texas, which is very famous for its music. So we sort of went out, whatever, 3 days beforehand. You do a lot of pre-filming, and then we were covering it there on the night. And it was quite funny, because when I was working at the BBC, the BBC is the big national broadcaster in the UK, and obviously there was Sky and ITN, but when they've got the sort of gantry of all the reporters and all the rest of it in this country, the BBC is at the front. Yeah, the Prime Minister, when there's any questions, will turn to the BBC first to answer them. When we're in America, there was just this huge sort of scaffolding construction. I suppose it must have been about, 8 stories high, with literally the world's press there. And obviously you've got CNN and all the rest of it in the prime position on the sort of front row. The BBC was sort of stuck up the top on the sort of 7th row to the side somewhere or other, and you have to sort of traipse over all these cables, and there's all these people talking in different languages and stuff. So we're very much not at the forefront of it, but it was great. It was great fun doing it. I mean, it's such an old cliche with sort of journalism like that, but you really are sort of watching history being made right in front of your eyes. Obviously, you're obsessed with getting everything right and getting all the satellites up and briefing the correspondent, who most of the time doesn't really know what's going on because they've got sort of headphones on and all the rest of it. And you're feeding them information about what results are and stuff. So it's exciting stuff. And if you want to ask me, do I miss it? No, I don't now. Too old.
You mentioned Salt Lake 2002, the Winter Olympics there, most famous, yeah, I guess, for British skiers and snowboarders, for being the Olympics when Alan Baxter won a bronze medal and then subsequently had it taken away from him following, yes, a positive drug test. We've covered that on the podcast a few times before, but that must have been kind of interesting being on the ground for that.
It was. I was actually standing at the bottom of the race course when it took place. And rather bizarrely, they always have the slalom on the final weekend. So I was in charge of the BBC news team out there, not the Olympic coverage. So we were doing the news. And I remember saying to the gang, well, you know, we've had an absolutely exhausting 2 weeks, you know, covering because of all the time differences and things. There's an Olympic skier, slalom skier, you know, Alan Baxter. He's top 10. He's all right. He won't win a medal, I don't think. But, you know, we perhaps ought to just go along just in case something happens. But, you know, no, he won't get a medal. He'll get a top 10 and they'll just mark it on the bulletins. And so we all went along hoping, you know, basically we could actually get a ski in the afternoon, to be honest with you. We're sort of standing there. And then in the sort of second run, I can't remember where he came, but he came and he put his run in and all the rest of it. And he did well. And then there was a real change in the temperature. So it was sort of icy at the top, and then the course got slushier and slushier the lower down you went. It was a very sudden change in the temperature, and then basically all the other people fell over. So all of a sudden, Alan Baxter was in with a chance of a medal. And yeah, he got the bronze medal. So it was quickly, right, we're not going skiing this afternoon, guys. Bad luck. And then I had to sort of rustle up a satellite truck and do some lights in there with a reporter. But yeah, so it was great. I don't know. I've been asked a lot about the Alan Baxter thing. But basically, I mean, he had a Vicks nail in inhaler, which he used because he had a cold. In Europe, it doesn't have any banned substances in. In America, it has something called methamphetamine B in it, which is a banned substance. So he got one off the counter in America. Obviously, with hindsight, he bitterly regrets it, and you could call him naive, but whatever. But at the end of the day, you know, it's quite clear. If an athlete has a banned substance in his body, or her body, then they're disqualified. So the court really had no option except to take his medal away. Lots of people say, oh, nobody won, but he did have a banned substance in his body, and those were the rules.
It is very sad. In some people's eyes, he will always be the first British alpine skier to have won an alpine medal on snow. But you were there for that. I think that's the most interesting thing. Most by accident, you stumbled into that story. And I love the idea that you can just say, oh, yeah, I rustled up a satellite truck. That's a summary of kind of the job that you were doing at the time, I guess.
Yes, well, the role of the job, the actual name of the job, it was fantastic. I mean, they gave it some fancy title. I can't remember what it was. But basically, we all called it the fixer. So the person in charge of the operation was known as a fixer, which, is, again, is exactly what you do. You fix things. You make things happen. I mean, we needed a satellite truck. I mean, I knew the people at NBC quite well, and they happened to have a spare one. So I just gave them a ring. Can you get your satellite truck over? We actually worked the timing. We worked out there was a garage sort of halfway between Salt Lake City and the resort where the race took place. And they parked in some garage and got their satellite up. And then we then sort of drove down to it as fast as we could. You know, that's the job of the fixer, is to know how to fix things. And you basically work on the basis that if it can go wrong, it will go wrong. So you need a plan B. It's slightly similar in the mountains. If you're going to go off piste, you know, ski, you know, if you're going to go skiing up a mountain or whatever, you need to plan for the worst case scenario in terms of the weather, if there's going to be an injury, if it's a connecting lift you may need to take doesn't work. You need a plan B in place so that when it does happen, you can react accordingly rather than just go, oh my God, what do we do now?
You mentioned, correct, if, you know, Alan Baxter hadn't done so well, you would have gone for ski in the afternoon. So you were evidently already a skier at that point in the early 2000s.
Yes, very much
had
so.
Had you been on snow much already prior to that?
Loads and loads and loads. That was 2002. So I was born in 1958. I'm 66 now. I actually first skied as an eight-year-old back in, in the 60s. That was one of the reasons I was asked to go and do the Salt Lake City Games for BBC News, because they knew I was a big skier and knew my stuff, knew all the people in the industry, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, and where did he start skiing when you were eight?
I went to a resort in Austria called Gargellen, which you may or may not have heard of. It's a very small resort. I keep meaning to go back there, but I never have. I've driven past the sign saying Gargellen 20-odd kilometres many times, but I haven't been back. My parents were big, big, big skiers, and we tended to go on winter holidays, not summer holidays back then. So I suppose in some ways, I mean, there was something sort of pioneers, really, of skiing. I mean, I'm talking about the early 60s when they started skiing. So it was Gargellen first, and then we went to Ischgl, which wasn't the big boozy party town that it now is, but was rather a quaint little sort of Austrian resort.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you talk about your background there, very similar to mine in respect of my parents were both skiers in the 60s when not many British people were. And we did winter holidays rather than summer holidays. We'd be more likely to go camping in the Isle of Skye or something in the summer. But the ski holiday would be our big holiday. And yeah, where I started skiing in St. Anton, and that was a far cry from the type of resort that it is now. If you started at eight, I mean, this is a question I'm sure you get asked a lot, because we're going to come on to your ski career now. Let's say maybe it started at Salt Lake in 2002, but do you have any idea of how many ski resorts you've been to?
No, is a short answer. Maybe about 7 or 8 years ago, I did tot them all up. I'd skied over 400 ski resorts in total. So what I've done now, I've no idea. What I do tend to do, I tend to count how many resorts I visit each winter, actually, rather than the total. But I must sit down and do it one day. And it's quite difficult. I mean, how do you define a ski resort as well? You know, back in the day, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with Verbier. I mean, there's Verbier, the resort, and then there's a resort across the valley called Brusson. which, I mean, I love Broussard. It's a fantastic little place. It's not so much a secret anymore, but it's a great little area. Anyway, back in the day, to get to Broussard, you had to get the lift down to Le Charble in the valley. Then you had to get a local post bus to some little chairlift. It was a two-man chairlift, and then get this lift up. So I counted Broussard as a separate resort to Verbier. Now you just get a gondola down and a gondola up. So I think that it's a linked resort. If I go to Broussard, it counts as Verbier in my book. But in a winter, I suppose, I mean, I tend to ski between sort of 50 and 70 different resorts each winter as I travel around, which everyone then opens their mouth and says, how on earth do you do that? Well, I mean, it's not as difficult as it sounds if you're in the industry, whatever. I mean, I tend to start skiing in October, usually on the glaciers around Innsbruck. I mean, there's five of them going up to 3,500 meters. So you can ski there. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, the ski season in Europe goes on till the end of May. So, you know, we've got months and months and months of it. And then, I don't say you go to the Port du Soleil. I mean, it's a fast ski, a long ski, but you can ski around the Port du Soleil in a day. Well, that's 12 different resorts. So there's 12 to start with in one day. So it is a lot, but it's not nearly as many as you might think.
It is a lot. You mentioned Broussard, firstly. I also skied over there for the first time about, I don't know, 3 years ago or something like that. And I can see
what did you make of it?
Fantastic. Fantastic. I was lucky enough to be with a guide, and we did a bit of hiking and a bit of ski touring, and there's loads of off-piste over there. Great area. But as you say, is that Verbier now, or is that a different resort? And for example, you're talking about the Port du Soleil. You ski through a lot of resorts there. Do you have a view on things like La Plagne or Courchevel, where you've got like five or six different resorts in Courchevel?
Courchevel is one resort, in my view. I mean, Merivale is a separate resort, but you can't count Courchevel sort of 1650 and Courchevel 1800. Courchevel is one resort.
And La Plagne, do you view that the same?
I view La Plagne as the same as well, yes. It's one ski area, and the village, I know they are separate areas, but I mean, no, I'd say it's La Plagne is one.
Well, listen, if you're totting up how many ski resorts you've been to, you can use that rationale. And now, moving into the skiing side of things, I think your final years at the BBC overlap with working at the Ski Club of Great Britain. You're working on their environmental policy, working as a content editor on the website. Is that right?
And as I mentioned earlier, I was sort of at the BBC, but I had a sort of separate life, shall we say. I had a sort of my skiing life, as well as having my BBC job. I actually wrote for some of the ski magazines. I wrote for sort of Ski and Board, which the veteran Arnie Wilson edited at the time. So I wrote for various sort of ski magazines. I did quite a lot for the BBC on skiing, actually, which was nothing to do with my real job. But when the BBC website got going and they wanted something on skiing, I knew the editor well. So they'd commission me to write something. And writing about helmets and all the rest of it. And then separately, at Christmas time, we used to go, me and the reporter and a cameraman, as Russell was the camera, Russell Hayes was the reporter. And then there was a fantastic BBC cameraman called Monty Johnson, who was also a Bayesian instructor. So if I said to him, well, can you ski backwards and film this? He said, oh, no problem at all, James. And we used to go out to Teen, actually, and make what we used to call stocking filler films, which back in the day, you'd make a load of stocking filler films to fill up the time over the Christmas and New Year period. So we'd go make those. They were primarily going out on it was News 24, as it was called then. It's now the News Channel. And if they were good enough, they sort of made it through to the 1 o'clock news or something. So I did that as well. So it's a sort of parallel life, really. And then I mentioned that the website, the BBC website, I was one of the first people to go there to help set up the BBC News website. There's a friend of mine, a guy called Mike Smart. Older people might remember him. He used to present the 6 o'clock news. He was one of the BBC's very good reporters. He was massively into the technology. He went off to set up the BBC News website. And he sort of turned to me and said, would you want to come and help as well? And I thought, well, that sort of sounds interesting. Websites, not really sure what they are, really. Most of my colleagues at Television News thought, what on earth are you doing, James? You're one of the news editors of BBC Television News. You know, quite a big job, quite responsible. The programmes are watched by millions and millions. It's not quite like it was now with all the other media. You know, the 1:06 and 9 o'clock news, as it was then, were big news bulletins. Why on earth are you going off to the sort of 7th floor to sort of sit doing something on the website? I said, well, I don't know. This website seemed quite interesting to me.
You mentioned Arnie Wilson. I've interviewed him previously on the podcast. Yeah. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. I mean, evidently, you've got a love of skiing that's been going for a long time. I think I'm right in saying that you're also a Bayesian qualified instructor as well?
Yes, a Bayesian qualified instructor. I mean, I became a ski club rep actually first, and it was a sort of progression quite a lot of us did. So I became a ski club rep, and I rep, well, I was fortunate enough to rep, I repped in, well, Sasfeld was my first one, and then I wanted to move around to Zermatt, and you could only go and rep in Zermatt, which was one of their sort of so-called Class A resorts, if you'd skied in the resort before. I'd actually spent an afternoon in Zermatt many years earlier, so I said, oh yes, I've skied in Zermatt. Didn't tell her it was only for an afternoon. And then I moved around to be the rep in Zermatt. And I repped in Zermatt for, oh, I can't even remember. I loved it there. 5 or 6 years or something. And then I repped over in Whistler. Then I came back and I repped in Verbier. But again, for, well, it must have been 7 or 8 times or something. So I was fortunate enough to rep in, yeah, some of the great resorts on the ski club's books, as it were. And then from that, a lot of ski club reps back in those days sort of progressed on to do the Baisy thing. Well, I was actually invited out to see a Baisy course by the then boss of Baisy, Bob Kinnaird, in, I think it was in the early 2000s, basically, to do a report. I can't know if you remember, but there were big arms between the French instructors and the British instructors who would teach where, all the rest of it. And then the French and the British patched it all up and were good friends. So I was invited out for, actually working for BBC Radio 5 at the time, just to do a story on this new rapprochement with the French and all the rest of it. So I came out and did that. And then Bob, who was, as I said, he was CEO of Baisy at the time, said, well, you know, you can sort of half ski. Why don't you come along and do some articles about how to become a ski instructor? And I thought, well, yeah, that sounds all right. So I did that. Yes, thank you very much. Again, I think I did the course on how to become a ski instructor at Baisy, and I passed. And then one of the trainers there is a guy called Julian Griffiths, who's a really, really good friend of mine. He runs a ski school in Verbier, European snow sport. And he said, well, look, James, you passed the course. Why don't you come and be a ski instructor for a bit? And I said, now, I'm not remotely interested in teaching beginners how to do a snowplow. Thank you very much. I would rather go skiing with my friends. He said, don't be such an idiot. It's fantastic fun. Yeah, you can stay at my place. So come on out. So I went out for a couple of weeks. I can't, it was either Christmas or New Year or half term or something. And I was absolutely hooked. I mean, I absolutely loved working as a ski instructor. You get a whole mix of people and just, I don't know, just passing on your enthusiasm is fun. But more importantly is that I never really thought I taught them anything, actually. What I always thought when I was teaching is you basically bring it out of them. So they come along with nerves and apprehension and all the rest of it. And you sort of really, I mean, my technique was the opposite to quite a few. I mean, Warren Smith, he's very technical about it all. My technique was basically make them laugh, make them smile, ski around, and they'll become better skiers because they're having fun.
That is a great philosophy. I really like that. And I'm not an instructor, but you mentioned Zermatt earlier. I was lucky enough to do a season in Zermatt when I was doing my seasons. And wow, what a fantastic place it is. And what incredible places to spend some time. But it's very interesting. I mean, that's probably a broader philosophical discussion about how you ski better. If you're relaxed, you're going to ski better, right? You know, that's a key part of it.
Correct. Make people smile is the absolutely crucial thing. Remember, they're on holiday. They're there to have fun. They're not there to be taught about how you angle this, that, and the other. And yeah, if you make them do, I always find if you make people do a lot of drills and exercises, they probably won't be able to do them. So that's sort of, oh, I can't ski on one ski. You know, oh, I'm not very good and stuff. You know, you can sort of build it in to what you do. But the key thing for me was always, always, always just to have a good time and smile and have fun. If you're race coaching, of course, that's completely different. But most of the people, they're on holiday, for goodness sake. You know, make them smile, yeah. Entertain them. It's almost a sort of secondary thing. They'll just become a better skier by default. Because skiing, I mean, a lot of people don't believe me, but skiing's a completely natural thing to do. It's not a weird thing like a golf swing, which is, you know, it's a natural thing to do.
So evidently, you know, you had a long history in skiing already. You're an instructor. You've been a rep for the Ski Club of Great Britain, you know, skiing since a young age. But I think it was in September 2008 that you founded Planet Ski, which is the website that you run now, and you're known throughout the industry as the man who covers every story within the ski industry. You mentioned you were involved at the BBC and you were interested in the website side of things, you know, quite early on, back in the 90s. What prompted you to start Planet Ski?
Well, I always, when I was at the BBC, I'd always thought I just want to retire, or rather leave the BBC at 50. I'd have done 22 years in the BBC. I looked around at people doing the job I was doing who were over 50. And yeah, they'd sort of run out of energy to go and do all the on-the-road stuff, which we were talking about earlier, because it is quite exhausting. And they sort of sat in the corner grumbling and moaning and going on about the good old days and all the rest of it. And I just thought, I just don't want to end up like that. I had a little go at management BBC. So I got promoted to be a manager for a while. I mean, really, honestly, I talk about the wrong job for the wrong person. I mean, I was not a manager. You know, I'm a sort of doer and get things done merchant. You cross the sort of river to become a manager, and all you do is go to meetings and talk nonsense and listen to nonsense and sort out people's problems. I was much more of a get on and do it merchant. So when they offered me, they've actually offered me the job full time, and I said to the boss, Fran Unsworth, who went on to become head of news, actually, I said, Fran, well, look, Fran, I don't know if I'm going to take it, but it's not me being a manager. So, yeah, so I decided I wanted to leave the BBC at 50. And then, as I said, I got involved with setting up the BBC website, which I enjoyed thoroughly. And then prior to leaving, I was actually going back to the ski club. I mean, I did repping for them. I went on to the council. I was on the environmental committee, as well, as you mentioned, a founder member there back in the day when the environment wasn't sort of big news topic, as it were. And then I sort of thought, well, you know, I could leave the BBC and run the ski club's website, perhaps, you know. And then Caroline Stewart Taylor, who was the CEO at the time, lovely, lovely lady. Not to put too fine a point, Caroline and I slightly sort of fell out because she wanted much more sort of glowing, sort of positive sort of stuff about skiing the whole time. Whereas, I mean, I'm a news journalist. Not all stories are positive. You know, there are negative stories as well. And if there's no snow, you need to tell people, I'm sorry, there's no snow. I mean, we didn't fall out at all. We're still very good friends, actually. But we had a sort of difference of opinion on what the website would look like. I wanted to be a sort of proper news website and bring some of my BBC skills over rather than it be a bit of a sort of PR puffy website. So I then thought, well, I don't know, why not just go set my own one up? So that's what I did. And I had two friends, actually, who made a lot of money in their time, actually. One was a guy called Charlie Parsons, who's, I mean, he was in television. He set up a company called the Planet 24, and he made the big breakfast and don't forget your toothbrush and Survivor, all sorts of things. Then there was another friend of mine called Tim Cook. He set up a website called Planet Retail. And again, he was well ahead of the game with gathering data on people. It was in the retail industry on food and shopping and all the rest of it. So I thought, Planet Ski, why not? So that's how the name came about. As I said, my background's news. So I always knew it'd be a news website, but I never really knew where it was going to go. It just sort of evolved, really.
You've made it clear. It's a news website. I mean, I'm guessing many of our listeners will be familiar with it already. But there's a lot of competition online between different websites. You know, what do you think resonated about the site that helped you build up your audience?
For me, I mean, going back, it's news. I mean, you say there's competition. I mean, with all due respect to the people that think they're running news websites, as it were, in my humble opinion, they're not. They do cover news. Yes, of course, there's some news on there, but they don't cover news. And news is news. News happens the whole time. I don't really regard any of the other websites out there as competition to Planet Ski. The competition is people's time on their device. So I'm competing with YouTube, with the Sky, with every single computer game, with TikTok. You're competing for people's time online. Why should someone spend their time looking at Planet Ski when they can be on Instagram or in a WhatsApp group chatting away to their friends? So I've got to make Planet Ski attractive for them to come and look at me rather than, I mean, I don't really look at any other websites, to be honest with you, saying, oh, I see so-and-so's got this story and I haven't. I just use my own personal and sort of gut feelings of what a news story is. And you've got to make it so people come to you, not do Google searches or whatever, or try and find out on Facebook. They want to come to Planet Ski. And as you said, it's really not up to me to say it. It's up to other people that, you know, people sort of turn to us, I hope, because we're sort of fast. We're on the ball. We're as impartial as we can be. There's no such thing as impartiality, obviously, but we do try to be. And we try to be sort of fair and honest. But that's really up to other people to say, not me, because I would say that because I run the thing.
Certainly very interesting. One of the elements of that, it's actually a question I had sort of planned for a bit later on, but I think I might ask it now. I mean, you said you report the bad news as well as the good news. You know, I always enjoy having a chat to you about events because you certainly say things as you see them. There's no couching your views around, I don't know, politics or anything like that.
I would agree with you. Yeah, I mean, I sort of see it as it is, and that's that, really. I keep saying I'm just an old-fashioned newsman. News is news. Facts are facts. I mean, in my view, there's far too many opinions around at the moment. I mean, lots of people seem to have an opinion on every single subject. Personally, I got an opinion about skiing because I have a certain knowledge about skiing, and I've got an opinion about journalism and how it works, because that's what I know. I don't know how to run the National Health Service or how to solve the problems in Ukraine or anything like that. But lots of people have opinions on things that really they don't know very much about nowadays. So that's sort of how I sort of view it. So when you say to me, we have lots of chats of these things, you ask me a question, well, I'll give you my answer. That's what it is. I remember, you've probably forgotten, it was at Earl's Court at the ski show there. I remember you came up and there was a sort of long queue or something to get in or something, and everyone was upset because they couldn't get in. And I wrote about that because it was true. And then you said to me, the great thing about reading sort of Planet Ski is you always say, report it how it is. And I thought, well, great, that's exactly what I want to do. If people don't like what Planet Ski does, well, that's absolutely fine. There's no, you might just want to go and watch YouTube videos of people skiing around and jumping in the half pipes or whatever. That's fine, go and do that. But if you want to sort of have an understanding of what's happening in news and what's going on in the ski world, told from as an objective a position as you can, then, you know, you might want to take a look at Planet Ski. That's my view.
That's excellent. I love what you're saying about facts and opinion. I always refer to the Disney movie Inside Out, where they're on a train and there's a box of facts and a box of opinions, and they all get tumbled out and they all get mixed up, and they go, how are we ever going to know which are the facts and which are the opinions? But while we're on those opinions, which I'm interested to know your thoughts, let's tackle a couple of things about the future of the ski industry. Now, people always ask me about climate change and, you know, the impact of climate change as we move on. And we're seeing more resorts go out of business. So one of the things that you've made very clear is that, you know, the way it gets reported sometimes is dramatically over the top. Oh, you know, ski resorts have closed down. Well, these are the ones that have closed are very small resorts. They have no international clientele. They tend to be community things. But looking into the future, do you see that extending to, you know, larger resorts at maybe at lower altitudes?
Well, it's a hard one. I mean, I prefix this by saying, I mean, I'm not a scientist or environmentalist. I don't know, is the honest answer, because I don't know enough about it. But I've obviously observed what's happening to the weather when I've been skiing over the last, whatever it is, 50 odd years, probably a bit more. And I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about it whatsoever that the temperature is going up. And there's absolutely no doubt about it at all that the glaciers are melting. So that is definitely happening. Generally speaking, there's less snow at low altitude than there used to be, but that doesn't mean there's no snow at low altitude. It depends on the time of year. So things are changing. The only thing I would say is people saying it's the end of skiing. Well, that's complete nonsense in the next 10, 20 years. Who knows? You can't really predict longer than that, but that's just nonsense because of all the headline, the clickbait stuff you see, you know, a story saying, you know, is skiing under threat? Will there be skiing? Blah, blah. It's going to get more people reading it than a sort of an objective analysis of the situation. So there's no doubt that climate change is affecting skiing, but it's not nearly as severe as people say.
What about another question then, something that we've covered quite a lot on the Ski Podcast, the rise of collective passes. You know, listeners will be aware of the Epic Pass and the Icon Pass, and in Europe, you know, the Magic Pass is becoming more and more popular. I wondered if you think those collective passes, because they keep adding on extra resorts, like Icon Pass announced last week, they're adding on the Oyster Valley. Epic Pass have added 5 Austrian resorts this year. Do you think those collective passes are going to have more impact in Europe over the next, you know, few years?
Well, undoubtedly, the first impact the collective passes is having already is many more Americans and people from North America are coming to Europe. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. Going to Verbier, you hear a lot of American voices which are sort of getting a lift, and I always say, oh, yeah, where are you from? How'd you come over? And most of them are on an Epic Pass. So there's absolutely no question that more Americans are coming to Europe. Through European eyes, I mean, I've had both an Icon Pass and an Epic Pass, and I had the Indy Pass, which is another one. So I've had them all. You've got to have a lot of time to go skiing. So if, for example, I mean, I got an Epic Pass when I was doing a month-long road trip in Colorado and Utah. So it was great. You know, I picked it up when I was in Utah, and you get this Epic Pass, and there's lots of resorts on there, and off you go. And then back in those days, there weren't so many European ones on there. But if you've got a few spare weekends, you could go to some of the European ones. It was great. And it's the same really with the Icon Pass. You know, they've got some big name American resorts and a whole lot of European ones now. You've got to have time to go and see all these places. Otherwise, you might as well just get a pass from the resort. The one I think is quite interesting, but I don't think it's for everyone, far from it, is the Indy Pass, which by it says it's sort of independent. And what they've got, and I had an Indy Pass last year, actually. I'm probably going to get one this coming coming season, actually. But they have a lot of smaller resorts, I mean, most of which you've never even heard of. And as I said earlier in this podcast, I mean, I'm a big fan of going to resorts I've never even heard of. They're all small. You wouldn't have a holiday there, but they're great. So if you want to go to some of this more independent and smaller resorts, it's good. And they've got quite a lot sort of in Europe now. They've just announced a whole load on the Indy Pass, including, well, the Port du Soleil. That's now on the Indy Pass. And Innsbruck, the town with its associated, I think it's 9 resorts. That's on the Indy Pass too. And Becerra in Spain as well. So they have got some big names on the Indy Pass.
That's really interesting. You mentioned Innsbruck. I think I referred earlier to the fact that you've been very lucky, I guess, to have the opportunity to spend extended time out in the Alps. You know, you base yourself in Pila and Innsbruck. You're in Japan just now. When you do that for a longer period of time, does it make you feel like a local at all on the hills instead of more of a tourist?
I wouldn't say a local as such. If you spend some time in a place, you just get to know it better. So I never felt when I was living in the Ulster Valley and going to Pila, which I mean, I love Pila. It's a fabulous, fabulous resort, which I think more people should know about and go to. I never thought I was Italian or something, but I just, you know, you get to know people, you get to know some of the ski instructors. So, you know, and once you've done that, you've sort of had a beer with them or had a ski with them, and then they sort of tell you what's really going on as opposed to what you might be told by the press office, shall we say. You sort of get under the skin of a resort rather than feel like a local. I mean, Innsbruck, I love Innsbruck. I think it's the most fantastic city. It's got some wonderful ski resorts around it. Most people haven't heard of them, sort of Schlick 2000 and Glum Geyser and Aximalism. There's a lift in Innsbruck itself, and you go up to Nordkette. And then equally, you've got sort of Stubai, the glacier resorts, St. Anton, Ischgl. They're about an hour away. So it's surrounded by lots of lovely, lovely resorts. But 3.5 months I was there just before COVID, and we loved it there on every single level. We were there. I was there last winter, actually, not the winter we just had, the previous one. Again, we rented a sort of an apartment in the centre of Innsbruck for a month or so. And you just get under the skin of the place. And if you don't feel like skiing, then you can go and do some other things or whatever. But the downside of what I do is running a news website takes an awful lot of time. So, you know, I can go and ski for a couple of hours in the morning and then come back and then get on with the work side of things.
Well, you've inspired me because now my kids are going to be leaving home later this year. My wife and I are going to go out to Chamonix and spend an extended spell out there. So hopefully, as you say, not necessarily going to ski every day, but the opportunity to have a kind of second winter season later on. You mentioned earlier that you were in Japan. I think you said you spent 6.5 weeks there. That's a whole podcast in itself. But how do you summarize your experience there last winter?
Well, Japan is probably the most unique place I've been skiing. I mean, it was fantastic. Just as well as the skiing, it's everything else. I mean, Tokyo is just a sort of city on steroids. It's unbelievable, Tokyo. And then you've got all the sort of temples you can go and visit as well. And the whole Japanese culture is so different to the Alps and anywhere else. And the food, I mean, obviously you've got to like sort of Asian food. I mean, if you don't like sushi and raw fish, there's plenty of other food to have, but you've got to like Asian food. But the food is absolutely out of this world. I mean, it's just stunning, stunning, stunning. But I always prefix, whenever people ask me about Japan, I always sort of prefix them. You know, there are some downsides to Japan. There's absolutely no question about it whatsoever. First of all, it's a hell of a long way to go. You can't fly over Ukraine now because of the war. So if you want to take a direct flight, it's 15 hours, which is an absurd amount of time to spend on an aircraft. So we actually stopped at Turkey. Well, we're skiing in Turkey as well, actually, which is another story. So it's a long way to go, first of all. Secondly, yes, it does snow a lot, but it also rains a lot too, because it's very low altitude. So all that powder snow, yes, you do have it, but it rains as well. Well, I was actually up in Sapporo last year after we'd been on the main island around Honshu. And when we were in the Hakuba Valley on Honshu, the main island, the snow was absolutely out of this world. It was that absolutely light talcum powder that everyone talks of. It really, if you haven't experienced it, it's another feeling altogether, just floating in snow. It was amazing. Anyway, so we then went up to the up north to Hokkaido, the island off the north, and we're in Sapporo. And my friend Warren Smith, he was in the Hakuba Valley about 10 days later, and he sent me a message saying, oh, it's raining here, the snow's awful, blah, blah, blah. And I said, oh, well, I've had a lovely time there, bad luck. Why don't you go jump on the bullet train and come up to Hokkaido? So he went, yes. So Warren came up to Hokkaido and we met up. So yeah, he just jumped on the train and came up. So the point I'm making is you don't always get that weather. Also, the resorts are very small. They're very small resorts. Most of them have a handful of lifts. The vertical is very small at all. So I would recommend to people, if you're going to go to Japan, you've got to be a powder skier. because that's what it's all about. Otherwise, it's a long way to go for some fairly average skiing on what are mainly hills, not mountains. But do it, I like Japan, probably the best place I've ever been.
That's a great summary. You know, I love what you're saying there about Japan. It's definitely on my list. I want to try that Japan myself. And, you know, actually, listener, I'll put a link into the show notes. I read through, James, your entire kind of live blog of your trip, which kind of went from resort to resort and covered the whole thing.
That would have taken a while.
It did take a long time. But fascinating to just to see the whole journey and get that kind of day by day insight into it. So I'll put a link into the show notes for that. We're getting towards the end now. So I've got one more question for you then. I mean, you've skied in, you know, so many different places. Where are you going to be skiing next?
Well, I'm actually going walking in a couple of weeks' time in the Alps and Saint-Gervais, but I'm not going to be skiing there. But for next winter, I mean, I'm not sure for the sort of November, October, November, December time, I'll probably be in the Alps. I'm doing a road trip and just going to some various resorts. I'll probably be in the glacier resorts in Austria in October. But the big one for us the next winter is we're actually going to Canada for 2 months. Canada. We're going to Canmore, which is a town near Banff in Alberta. Our eldest son, me and my wife's eldest son, Alex, he actually worked as a ski instructor in Sunshine Village, which is one of the Banff resorts, for three winters, and he was there all summer. Anyway, long story, he did that. Then he went to ski and teach in Australia, came back to London, lived in London for 5 years. He's now emigrated back to Canada and he's living in Calgary. So I just thought, Keisha and my wife and I thought, well, it's a bit of a shame that he's going to Canada. Well, let's make the most of this then. So why don't we rent somewhere in Canada? So we're renting a two-bedroom apartment in Canmore in the mountains, which is only about an hour from Calgary. So we're going to be there. Our son will come and see us. I mean, I love Canada. We'll be going and skiing at a lot of the resorts in Alberta. I mentioned the passes earlier on. I'm likely to get an Indy pass, actually, because there's quite a lot of small independent resorts in Canada, most of which I haven't even heard of, actually.
Oh, well, that sounds fantastic. Another adventure to add onto the list and more resorts to tick off. I think you'll enjoy Saint-Gervais as well. I was actually out there last week, and I'm guessing that while you're there, you'll probably go to the actual spa itself, which I can highly recommend. A brilliant way to recover after, in my case, a bit of hiking around the mountains, probably what you're going to be doing too. That's brilliant, James. Thanks so much for that. I really appreciate you sharing your time with us today.
Okay, Ian, it's an absolute pleasure to speak to you.
Brilliant. That's great.
Well, listener, hopefully you enjoyed my conversation with James Cove from Planet Ski. You can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at Ski Podcast. You can also follow us on WhatsApp for exclusive material released ahead of each podcast. Look in the show notes for that link. If you'd like to help the podcast, there are three things you can do. You can follow us or subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can give us a review on Apple Podcasts or leave a comment on Spotify. And if you're booking ski hire this winter, don't forget you can save money on your ski hire with an additional discount by using the code SKIPODCAST when you book at InSportRent.com. Simply take the link in the show notes for your discount to be automatically applied. And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.